sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Stocks eke out a gain for the week. U.S. starts invasion of Iraq. And there's a three-day ceasefire in Israel. And our guest today, Mr. Money Mustache. You're going to find out more about that soon. All this and much more on episode number 376 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. Hopefully you were able to catch me this week on Frank Curzio's great podcast. We talked quite a bit about many stocks, the markets, the economy, the world, all sorts of things affecting your investments. You can find that over at stansberryradio.com. Over on iTunes, just look that up. Look up Frank Curzio, or just do a web search of Frank Curzio, and you'll find plenty of information on his great his show, his newsletters, everything about what he does. And we had a really good time. It was about about a 45-minute interview. We had an extended time together, so we were able to get to a lot of different really good topics. And by the way, if you want to ever contact me, just send a note over to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and I'll do my best to answer any questions that you may have. And if I don't have them, I'll let you know, and we'll look them up to find out what's going on. Anyway, let's talk about what's gone on in the markets. Quite the roller coaster week last week. Clearly, there was a considerable amount of worry and anxiety that surrounded every move of Russia at the Ukrainian border. And it seemed that it was building up to a point of absolute invasion going into probably about Wednesday. There was a commentary by a Polish political official and talked about how it was an imminent look at what was going on, that there was going to be an absolute invasion by Russia. The buildup of troops on the border was very concerning, and that really sent the markets into a tailspin. It was a pretty good week of selling, high volume and distribution across the board. Pretty much nothing was spared. Gold did, in fact, go up towards the end of the week. We did see that there was a good amount of safety trade, the quest to look for something that would support your money and looking for a way out in the event there was going to be something that happened there. And it's interesting that we did see a lot of selling here, but really the brunt of all that had happened really took place in Europe. Remember something, that the Germany is a very big trading partner, both imports and exports, when it comes to Russia. In fact, when you look at the amount of their economy that's really dependent on Russia, it's quite significant. Only second in some areas to China. So when we see that there's all these sanctions that have been pressed on against Russia, and Russia then retaliated and put some sanctions on imports from the countries that were putting sanctions on them. In other words, just saying, hey, you want to hit us? We're going to hit you back. Well, what happened was that Germany, being the largest trade partner with them in Europe, really took the brunt of it, and the DAX got hit pretty hard for the week. Now, we also are a pretty significant trading partner, and you have to wonder, and I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, I said, you know, where is the point where we're going to stop putting on any kind of sanctions? Because if you get to a point where we are putting on so much sanctions that we pretty much choke off the economy of Russia, well, doesn't that really hurt us? Isn't that really going to provide us with a significant amount of sanctions as well? It's going to reverse on us, because if we're going to really say, hey, you know what, Russia, you continue what you're doing, we are going to put all sorts of tariffs and bans on exports and imports. Well, what happens to the country here? What happens to the companies that are going to actually be involved in the export business with Russia? They're going to get hurt pretty significantly. And that's why we saw the Dow fall so tremendously. You had the industrials and the major companies that deal with the global export and import of goods from all sorts of areas really get hurt. And that was primarily due to the fact that you have these sanctions that are going on. Now, not to mention the fact that we saw some concerning numbers in China last week, even though China this week is found to have done more stimulus in the last several months in order to pick up their economy than they've done since 2012. And that's what's helping them a bit, particularly on the manufacturing numbers. Their service numbers have not been so hot. As a matter of fact, the latest round of their service numbers that came in last weekend were the lowest on record since recording began about 6 or 7 years ago for the service index. So China is slowing down. We have this Middle East conflict that's going on. We have Europe in a deflationary market. We'll talk in a second what Draghi had said and what he talked about. And then on top of it, we have all these bans that are going on and the sanctions that are happening within Russia and against us from Russia. And overall, you have to add that up, and it shows that there's going to be some a good amount of drawdown probably in GDP. Now, let's just get back for a second on what was the result of the ECB's discussion and their rate announcement earlier in the week. Mario Draghi spoke in the morning about, I think it was Tuesday, about the direction of the Eurozone economy as well as the plans for the ECB. And with all the problems associated to the Russian situation, the slowdown involved there, he's obviously, I mean, it seems very obvious that he's running a bit scared. And it's apparent that he's doing what he can really to instill some confidence in the fact that the ECB will remain very accommodative for an extended period of time. We've heard that 100 times before from our Fed. And really, well, there's nothing to worry about as far as he's concerned. Now, some of the highlights from his commentary that he made, he's seeing a pickup in demand for loans, which is really kind of interesting. Now, remember something, that Italy last week announced that they had a secondary quarter of contraction in GDP, meaning that they are back in recession. Draghi also said that there's a low level of private investment was a major reason behind the weak Italian GDP number. So we're seeing that private investment is down significantly. The negative deposit rate that they put on has been successful so far. It's kind of interesting to see that when there's a low level of private investment, but okay. Fundamentals for a weaker exchange rate are much better than a couple of months ago. In other words, you see that the euro has come down in value. And that makes sense when you see that the economies inside the eurozone are weakening. If you remember something, when Draghi came out with the negative deposit rates, there was an immediate knee-jerk reaction that moved down the euro. And that was rather significant for probably 2 or 3 days. And then the euro moved higher again. One of the things was that with the Europe being so accommodative, and with the ECB actually being accommodative, what happened was that there was a big push into, hey, wait, stocks are going to do really well here. And there was a lot of investment inside the country thinking that there was going to be a big opportunity. Now, with that, the euro started moving higher, but then reality hit. We did see that there was weakening fundamentals across the entire zone. And of course, all the things that are going on with Russia and the reversal of the transaction that where we saw money going into that economy, it started to just flow out. Okay, now, he also says there's been a decline in short-term capital inflows. That's exactly what I'm saying. There was all this inflow that happened that was creating the upsurge and the surge of the value of the euro against the dollar in particular. See, the thing was that even though the U.S. was looking like there was going to be a increasing rate environment over time, not right now, but over time, and the fact that the Fed was moving back on their bond buying purchases, right, the program, the QE program, well, what you would see there was that the dollar started rising. What you should see was the dollar started rising and there was a drop in the euro. But again, that didn't happen initially. Just for a few minutes it did. But after that, we saw that the dollar started moving down again. Now, whether or not, here's the interesting thing, whether or not there was this movement lower for the euro due to the fact that the negative deposit rates are working and other things on the economy were related, or it's the fact that there is a flight to safety due to all the global instability and problems that we are seeing, and money is coming into the dollar, or there is money coming to the dollar because there is a significant amount of thought that, hey, you know what? The Fed is serious. The economy is getting better in the U.S. Okay, fine. That moves the dollar higher. There is going to be a slowing down of the bond buying to nothing in October, and potentially 6 months later, there's going to be a rate increase. Now, if all that is the case, well, you would see the dollar moving higher and naturally the euro moving lower. In other words, money comes out of other currencies and moves into the U.S. dollar. So is that the case? Or is it that all the things that the ECB is doing is working? But the one thing that he said probably was the most significant item was that markets have perceived that the euro and the U.S. monetary policies are going to stay on a divergent path for a long period of time, which underscores exactly what I am saying in the latter part of my discussion, which is that there is a perception out there that the euro is going to drop or stay weak due to the fact that we see the economies there weakening and the fact that the ECB is going to maintain a very, very accommodative program for some time while the U.S. is reversing its program. You see how that works? So that's what's going on. It seems to be more likely than, I think, than the ECB's programs are working. I think really it's more so the concern over the fact that there is a Fed here that is saying, hey, you know what? We see strengthening in the economy in the U.S. and, well, we're going to do something about it. Now, we did see a good pop, a really nice over 1% move on the S&P 500. Big move on the Dow, the NASDAQ as well on Friday. This happened all about 1 o'clock in the afternoon when there was an announcement that there was some kind of a pullback, a consolidation of the troops that were building on the Ukraine border from Russia. And as such, a sigh of relief and an end-of-week rally that was necessary. It was kind of getting a little bit long in the tooth, this selling that was going on and this concern and this fear on this news item. And what happened and what we saw was that the markets responded very, very quickly. I mean, it was vertical most of the day. Now, unfortunately, volume was a little light. And then what happened was that there was a pressuring of the futures after President Obama delivered a statement that said that, you know, these humanitarian drops were coming and Iraq was being invaded. And then we're going to see what happens moving forward. But, you know, again, this buying that has been prevalent on lack of any news or on better news that really pushes the markets very quickly. And the short squeeze that have gone on in the past is still there. Everybody's saying, hey, you know what? This is the beginning of the end. What do we see? A 3%, maybe a 4% move down on the Dow and the S&P 500. Clearly, the Russell was much lower over the last several weeks. And you saw this big move, this return of the buyer on Friday in earnest after this announcement, even though we saw that economic numbers in the U.S. Friday morning showed that inventory builds were much lower than anticipated. And that means that there's going to be probably a chop to the GDP. We did see a quarterly number at 4%, which was outstanding, a big turnaround from last quarter. The big question is going to be what happens moving forward. We're now seeing that there's already some leakage of the economic numbers, probably due to some of the things that are going on in Europe, some of the things that are going on in Russia. And I would think that we have to be very wary of what's going on. Inventories only increased 0.3% in June after, again, another downward revision from the previous month. So that was, I think, kind of important. But we did end the week on a plus note, very, very slightly on the S&P 500, and that was pretty good. So this is the first full week in August. It was a good upbeat note. It was a turnaround day from the bottom to top. In other words, we saw a long wick on the daily chart showing that we did bounce off the lows very nicely, held them. I think we clipped on the futures in the S&P, we clipped 1900 just for just real close to that. 1904 is a very important number for the S&P 500, the cash S&P. And we did hold that pretty well throughout the week. There was a few times that it did break through. It kind of sat there at, you know, 1902, 1901. And then, again, we saw this move higher dramatically. There was some news out there about companies. A lot of companies came in with earnings. And it seemed that no matter what the earnings were earlier in the week, stocks were getting beaten up pretty badly because the sentiment has changed so dramatically. Now, we also saw, as I mentioned earlier, a lot more volume on the markets. And the big question is going to be, moving forward, is what we saw something that's going to continue on, where we see that every time the market would pop a bit, it would just be chopped right back down. Kind of reverse of what we saw over the last several months, where anytime there was a downtick in the markets, there was a reversal and a buyer that would step in, or buyers, or, you know, buying that would step in and would move the markets much higher. The big question is going to be of how much of the distribution that we saw was really news related, or was it something more dealing with the longer term fundamentals and actions by the Fed in the minds of investors? But again, you have to weigh all this, because we didn't see bonds do anything significant. We didn't see any real rush to gold, even though gold did come up pretty nicely a couple of days there. We didn't see anything really, maybe more than just the margin accounts and the leverage that was out there get a little bit drawn down due to the fact there was all this news that was out there. So I'm not sure how concerning we are right now, even though we see that everybody and their brother are expecting a significant break in markets. We'll have to see. But right now, that reversal day has been something that we've seen before. That reversal day on Friday was something that in the past has been a buy signal. You see that it ticks down, and then midday it does close much higher than the open and probably higher or close to the high from the day before. That has been a buy signal in the past. So just keep that in mind. Now, we're going to get to our guest. When I come back, I want to talk about, after we finish with a good discussion and an interview with Mr. Money Mustache, I do want to talk about something that's going on with Apollo Management, Apollo Global. They're opening up a new fund, and I think it's kind of interesting what they're doing. We'll talk about that and a couple other things to note for the week ahead. All right, we're joined today with a special guest. His name is Pete, but we're going to call him what his blogging name is, what he goes by in the world. It's Mr. Money Mustache. How are you, my friend?
Thanks a lot, Andrew. It is great to be here. I'm doing very well.
Hey, let me ask you something. Let's just start with the whole mustache thing and get that out of the way, all right? So there is a picture, I believe, on your blog of a guy with a handlebar mustache. Do you actually have the handlebar mustache?
Well, that's me, and that was my mustache at one point, but I found it was very high maintenance to have such a decoration on my face, and I was using conditioner, and it required special care, so usually I don't have a mustache.
You know, it's funny, because I put two categories in the same, or two things in the same category as, wow. One is the bow tie. You know, when was the first time somebody decided to wear a bow tie, and then they just had to be the bow tie guy, right? And when was that first time that somebody decided to do a handlebar mustache, and then, you know, to kind of continue that, and the amount of work that must be involved with the tweaking and the spinning and the twirling and the waxing and all that good stuff, right?
Yeah, I think it all depends on your vanity, you know. And if I was a banker or the mayor, then it would be worth mustache maintenance because of the public image. But as a blogger and family man in a small city, then, you know, nobody really appreciated the mustache to make it worthwhile.
I hear you. So let's get beyond the mustache and talk about a little bit why you're here. One of the things that I found interesting and fascinating was that you, in your early 30s, just when you turned 31, I believe, you decided that, hey, it's time to retire. And my understanding also, and tell me a little bit more, but my understanding was it wasn't like you hit the, you know, the lottery and you said, hey, wow, you know, I got billions of dollars and I'm not working anymore. It was more so a decision of lifestyle, right?
That's true. The story is more or less correct, but it didn't just suddenly happen at 30. It's basically in my mid-20s, my girlfriend and I, who later is now my wife, sort of started planning and realizing we weren't really into spending all our money, so maybe we should start investing it. And we'd been doing so for a number of years already. But at that point, we got serious about it and realized we wouldn't mind having a kid or two at some point and not have to be married to our careers by the time the babies came along. So that's what really kicked off the final savings blitz. And then at around age 30, we had enough to retire and live off of the passive income generated by investments.
So what's interesting is that one of the most expensive things that I have experienced in my life is my kids. And you had kids and decided to retire anyway. How do you keep the whole cost factors you know, in line when it comes to all the kids' things, the things that are necessities, right? You have two kids, you have two adults, so that's four people. There's eating, there's clothes, there's, you know, the various things of school and supplies and all that. I mean, how do you keep all that in check?
Right. Well, I mean, the first shortcut I took, which wasn't done because of cost, but I have only one son instead of multiple kids.
All right, there you go.
That's just a choice my wife and I made for our own balance and the way our son's personality is. He likes that better too. But really, your spending on kids is uniquely kind of one of those things that can be anything. Kids can range anywhere from free up to millions of dollars per year per kid. And it's really up to the parents to decide how they want to run their lives. But a lot of people assume that it's the outside world imposing these costs on them, and that's where you get into trouble. You know, if you say stuff like, well, I need to have a 7-passenger GMC Tahoe because I have two kids, and, you know, they have like all this big stuff, you know, that's a self-imposed cost, which is completely fictional. So we just take the middle road. You know, we don't deny our son anything. We make sure he gets the ultimate rich educational life, but it just doesn't happen to cost much because we don't choose to buy a lot of expensive things as part of that.
And how old is he now?
He's 8.5.
8.5. Let me just tell you something from somebody who just sent two kids that just graduated college and one that's in college now. Those small expenses that occur, the things that they need but or maybe don't need but want to have, it gets progressively more expensive as they get older.
Or it gets progressively cheaper because in my upbringing, you know, I got everything free as a little kid, but by the time I was 12, there were no freebies other than food. So if you want to, you know, if you want to get some nice clothes for school, then you take your earnings from your part-time job and you buy that 1980s jean jacket or whatever. And
I still have one of those.
Yeah. Paid for my own college education and, you know, rode a bike through university instead of having a car. So yeah, you really don't have to have an umbilical cord connected to your adult children and pay for all this stuff, especially if you kind of build self-sufficiency at an early age.
You know, I got to tell you something. I totally agree with the concept. I really do. I agree with what you're saying and all. I mandated that my son would not have a job. He wants a job. He would take a job. He's a DJ, makes actually really good money doing it. And his freshman year of college, I said, you're not working. I want you to just focus on school. I want you to focus on, you know, what you need to do in this whole next 4 years, what you need to make happen in that time period. And I guess I took a little bit of a different route here. But yeah, I mean, listen, when I was growing up, I always had a job as well. I mean, I worked in the Chinese restaurant. I worked in the Italian. I worked at the A&P. I mean, all over. Whatever it is to make some money so I could have my own spending money. That was my personality. A lot of kids these days, on the other hand, are being brought up that, you know what, it's a free ride till, what, 30? Something like that, right?
Yeah, the richer the parents are, the higher these compulsory expenses seem to be. And people think that raising a child is more expensive the wealthier they are. And it's just nice to uncouple that. It's great if you do things based on your own values. You know, if your son and you both agree that focusing on the course load is his best education, then that sounds good to me. I just happen to have a different approach. You know, I'm actually a little bit cynical about education now, even though I got 4-year advanced degree myself. I think I could have got a lot better education if I'd been spending less time studying and more time starting businesses during part of my, you know, part of those years.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to something here now. So one of the things that you did was you decided that back in about 2005 that, and the reason why, by the way, just a little backdrop here, the reason why we're talking about this, we talk about finance and making money and investments all the time. One of the things that you have to realize, though, is what's the point of the investment, right? Is it a game? Okay, fine. Part of it's a game. Part of it is enjoyment. Part of it's the hunt, the conquering of something and getting that great stock that maybe is a 10-bagger. But the other side of it is the whole point of investing for your future and for the ability for you to have money to maintain a certain level of comfort, certain level of lifestyle, and whatever that level is for you, right? But now here you are back in 2005, and you know you decide to cut your expenses by what? Was it 50% or so?
Well, it wasn't cutting my expenses, but our expenses were always about 35 to 40% of our take-home pay. So, you know, if we were taking home, let's say, $100,000 a year, between us, we were spending $35,000, and that leaves the other $65,000 available to invest.
And now you had to make a decision that you don't have that income anymore, but you have passive income, income maybe from investments and things of that nature. And now you have to make the, at that point, make that decision that, okay, here we go, make taking the plunge, we're cutting off that spigot, right? How do you go about that initially?
Well, it's pretty easy. You just send a letter to your boss saying, yeah, well, I'm not coming to work anymore.
I get that. Yeah, yeah. Screw off, boss. I get that point. I'm talking about now. I'm talking about living.
And that's the most fun part. But then you, and in the case of my retirement, I had some rental houses as well. So you still get the rent checks coming in. And then you just start spending them on groceries instead of buying so many investments each month. Now, if you have an all-stock portfolio, you might set your dividend checks, which are probably currently set to reinvest. You'll tell them to get transferred to your checking account instead. And you'll just, case-by-case basis, you might set an automatic share sale every quarter of a tiny, tiny percentage of your portfolio, unless your dividends are more than you're spending already, in which case you're even more thoroughly covered. So the mechanics of it are quite simple. As long as you have stocks that are easy to sell and, you know, a reasonably balanced kind of non-leveraged portfolio.
Now, this is back in 2005, and everything was peachy keen back then, and everything's looking like, hey, you know, we got these investments, they're worth X amount of dollars, and, you know, wow, we could take the dividends and we can send them to ourselves. We got this rental income, it's all doing well, and these houses and all that. And fast forward 2 or 3 years, and all of a sudden, the world looks a little bit different, didn't it?
It does, although from a pure early retirement perspective, it wouldn't have really affected me because the dividend yields of the S&P 500 dropped, but not a huge amount like the dividend, the quarterly checks, because a lot of the old stalwarts kept their dividend payments. And if you retire on a multiple portfolio, like rental houses in my case, and stocks, then you're even more well covered because, you know, you still get your rental incomes unless all your tenants run out of money and you have permanent vacancies, which is pretty rare. So the sticker price of stocks is one thing, and that's what makes the news headlines, but the actual income from your retirement portfolio is a totally different thing, and that's hardly affected at all by crashes. Even the great financial crisis was a pretty minor dip, and sure enough, just a few years later, we're already at bigger records than ever. So as long as you don't get scared by that stuff, it really is nothing to worry about.
Well, but as you're going through it, you had to be scared. Let's be honest, you have real estate collapsing. You don't know if your renter is going to stay, and if he doesn't stay, who's going to come in, right? You got the same expenses that you had. Your kid was, what, 5 or 4 years old at the time? Maybe he wasn't born then. Well,
yeah, 2008. He was yet to be born.
Okay, yet to be born 2008, 2009. You have your stock portfolio that's just shrinking and going down. You know, and I get the fact that you're able to live, but it couldn't have been just like smooth sailing. Come on, you had to be a little bit nervous.
Well, I wasn't nervous about the stock prices because I've read enough stock market history that I thought that's just a big buying opportunity. My only regret was that I didn't have much cash at that time because the first thing I did after retiring was starting what I thought would be a retirement hobby job, which is a house building company,
mm-hmm.
a small custom house building company, so I could do fancy carpentry. And then the second house that we built finished right in time for the local housing market crash. So then I was stuck with this place that I couldn't sell. And it was easy to rent out, but you know, that was where my source of stress is just basically my small-time hobby business happened to be affected by the housing crisis. Stock part, though, like, the stock market crash, because I don't read the news regularly, I don't read financial news because it's kind of just daily noise. I really don't care at all what the indexes are doing. It doesn't frighten me. It doesn't affect me. The only thing is occasionally they go on sale and I think, oh, I got to buy some more of those.
You know, it's funny because we talk about the news quite often on the show. We talk about, you know, one of the things that's really troubling that it causes more harm than anything else is the whole idea that, you know, these news headlines oftentimes are misleading. And if you get yourself totally embroiled in reading the news headlines, I'm not talking about if you're a professional, I'm talking about just your average, you know, your average guy or gal out there, and you really get swayed by all of the, you know, individual news headlines, it's very, very difficult to find anything that is really, you know, going to make you calm. One of the big things that we do know is that bad news, negative headlines sells much more than positive headlines. You know, the expectation in life is that, hey, you know, things are good and hopefully they'll get better, et cetera. But when we see that bad thing, a lot of times people will gravitate. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of studies done on this. And I know for a fact that when you look, for example, at 2009, the page views on like MSN Money and Bloomberg and all that were just off the charts. when there's good things happening, all that, people kind of are complacent or more complacent. They sit back and all that. So I can think what you're saying has a lot of benefit to people, that you don't have to necessarily, it's nice to know what's going on, but you don't have to read every single thing that's going on. And more importantly, I think, and you could tell me what you think, you don't have to react to everything that's going on.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I go further than that. And I actually advise people to not watch, especially not watch the news, like never, zero in your whole life. Like, television news is total garbage. But even reading the news is too short term and too much focused on like daily political battles that aren't really going to teach you anything about the bigger picture of the earth and what the human race is doing. So I try to do everything through books. So if anything's important enough to not be super temporary, just gossip of the day, it's going to show up in a book. So get all of your news through books that were written the next year or several years back, and that way the noise automatically gets filtered. You get someone who's generally more educated and a better writer to summarize all this stuff for you, and you get the bigger picture. And people say, I couldn't possibly miss out on all this important stuff, but it really doesn't work that way. You just don't need the news. And in the form of stocks, for example, I don't own any individual stocks, just index funds, but I'll check the value of those at most once every three months. You know, I'll just be like, what's the S&P index doing these days? Oh, it's 5% higher than 3 months ago. Okay, that's it for now, which is a little bit scary to a financial. I used to be a financial addict, and I would check S&P index 10 times a day. This is actually a better way to live, in my opinion. It's the big picture, slow, deep knowledge, stuff that matters 100 years from now, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, in my profession, we have to know. It's like anything else. You need, if you're in the profession, you need to know what's going on in the world of what you do. Obviously, we're talking about more so kind of taking a deeper breath and a picture from afar, understanding what's happening, which obviously is a much better way to have a long-term portfolio investment, because unless you're trading or you're active, there's no need for an understanding of what's going on a regular basis. I want to skip over to something though. What effect, if any, has your lifestyle, by cutting back on what you're spending and the things that you do, and maybe how you then interact with friends and all that, how has that affected your friends? And more so, have any of your friends picked up on it and said, you know what, we could do this too?
Definitely. Yeah, I feel it's been a pretty giant change for the better for me, or for my whole family, my wife and son and I, because we've just gradually become closer to friends who are, just a bit, take things a little bit more slowly and less materialistically. And we happen to live in a fairly, natural area of the country. It's like the city of Longmont, Colorado, in this historic neighborhood. So it's not really like a go Washington DC suburb full of commuting lawyers or anything like that. It's like a lot of entrepreneurs and professors and this type of people who live in this neighborhood. And so great friends there, no problems relating to not being a big spender. Nobody cares about what kind of car each other person has, and it just frees us up to spend more time doing what we like doing, like sitting on the front porch drinking wine and talking about life, or letting the kids play together, doing science experiments, starting little businesses, and reading books. It's kind of like it's almost like a post-rush society. It's like a more...
It's kind of like an advanced Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah, I guess you could think of that. Except it is in the middle of a super affluent, high-tech company area right next to Boulder, Colorado. And, but it's a modern version of that, I guess.
But now, how has that affected your friends? Have you had friends that you could identify that have done, let's even say, an identical thing to what you've done?
For sure. In general, most of the people I'm close with have drifted a little bit towards this Mr. Money Mustache lifestyle, which is just, for example, you bike your kids to school. We all have young kids, so instead of driving them to school, we ride our bikes with them to school, even when there's snow on the ground and things like that. And people are just generally reusing materials more, using Craigslist to buy and sell stuff. Just a bit more environmental and consumer awareness. And it's a fun hobby. It saves you a lot of money, but it's also kind of a more meaningless life. A more meaningful life, because you're not...
Yeah, and it's funny, because I'm thinking, for example, the whole idea of these bicycles and riding them. I mean, it's kind of, again, I'm not trying to say this in a negative way, but it's kind of like Quaker. It's kind of like a simple, more kind of a laid back, but a back in time kind of lifestyle in a way. And yeah. I don't mean it negatively. I don't mean it that way at all. I'm just saying it just seems to me that more simple. Simple, that's the word. Simple.
Yeah, I would never take that negatively. That sounds great to me because it's actually, we're taking the best out of past human cultures and trying to bring it back. For example, instead of helicopter parenting where your kids are protected and a bulletproof SUV and going from one expensive activity to another, in my neighborhood and my group of friends, the kids just run freely on the quiet streets and mingle and like play in the park, dig muddy holes in the backyard. And then when it's dinner time, you call for them and you don't even know whose house they're at. And that's how I grew up in the 70s. And it's great to bring that back because it actually is better for kids. And yet we're still combining it with the best of the new. So we're like a lot of education through the internet and, you know, advanced courses that we can take online and stuff. So we have access to the best science and computer software design and music creation kind of stuff in our home life. So it's amazing, like hybrid life of new and old.
So now one of the things that like you have to, I would think that you'd have to have maybe a short list, but maybe a long list of things that maybe you miss. I mean, for example, do you say, you know what, we're within the budget this month, we're not getting the ice cream, or we're not, you know, going to Disney or whatever. I mean, Disney, for example, at what, $100 a person right now is probably off limits, right?
No, it's not at all like that. The way we live our life is we look across the whole world and everything that's possible to do, and then we do whatever we want according to our values, which basically are, you know, health and education, meaningful connections to other people. We don't restrict anything based on cost, and that's because we actually have a lot more nowadays than when we retired, just because of continuing to earn and invest. So we could multiply our spending by a big, big multiple and go to Disneyland every day if we wanted. But that's just not what we consider important. So spend as much as we can, live a crazy decadent life, in my opinion. And it happens to add up to about $25,000 a year for the three of us. And yeah, if it was fun, if something's worthwhile, we'll do it. But it just, so far in these 9 years, it hasn't added up to very much.
$25,000 a year. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I know. It's because it's all based on habits, right? Like if I could be in the habit of some really expensive stuff and feel like I was scrimping to get by and still spend $100,000, and at the same time, just retraining yourself to have different habits. Like, for example, my habit, when I want to go somewhere, I hop on my bike and I go there. If I have to carry big stuff, I connect a trailer to my bike and I go there. So it would never occur to me to drive a car somewhere, even though I have cars. And that costs me $0 instead of, you know, a lot more for cars. And thus, I never have to replace my cars. And I never get, you know, I don't get like diabetes and other things that 40-year-olds get these days because I'm biking all the time. So there's kind of a chain reaction of good stuff and lower costs that happens if you adopt certain behaviors, which I happen to think make me a lot happier too.
I got to tell you something. This is so outside of my spectrum of, you know, because my life, it seems, has been about making money and, of course, then spending money and, you know, doing what I want to do, traveling, doing and all that and having a good time, et cetera. Not going crazy, not going underwater financially in terms of debt. No, none of that. Okay. But, you know, the whole idea of biking and all that. But I'll tell you something, though, what's interesting. You know, anything takes time to get used to that's different. I think we'd agree with that, right?
Yeah, that's human nature, for sure.
So about 3 years ago, I decided, you know what? I no longer can get by with just either elastic pants or buying a larger size anymore, right? I'm done with this. So I went on a diet and I cut out carbs. And what's interesting is that I really like carbs, whether it's pasta, whether it's something crunchy like a chip or cracker or something like that, you know, bread. Yeah. And at first I was really like, wow, man, I miss this stuff. Oof, I mean, I can't take it, you know, but you progress on, you do your thing to lose the weight. And I came down like 50 or 60 pounds. And for the last 3 years, I've been very, very light on the carbs. As a matter of fact, you know, today I ordered like a sub for lunch, but I didn't eat any of the bread. I just ate the meat, just the proteins. And I enjoy that. What's interesting, though, I do find is that when I snap back and I start eating some carbs, you know, just not going crazy, but I have more of an appetite for the carbs. You follow what I'm saying? I mean, this is a few levels away from what we're talking about, but it's the same concept in that, you know, you get used to something and you can actually not only do it, but also enjoy it. right? You don't have to suffer through it. So the thought of me getting on my bicycle and putting something on the back, much less putting something on the back of it to trail or around with me, okay, is quite repulsive sounding. I'll tell you.
Just, how dare you?
Yeah, well, I'm just telling you. I mean, you know, it just sounds awful. I'm not saying go out for a leisurely bike ride. I'm talking about using the bike for, you know, me being the horse and carrying the cart.
Yeah.
But I get it. I get what you're saying. You get used to it and it becomes an easy thing and it becomes natural. And, you know, it's almost unnatural to get into a car. Like it would be unnatural right now for me to eat a bowl of pasta.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're getting it. I'm glad that you find it at least somewhat shocking, the stuff I'm describing to you, because that's really kind of the point of the blogs, to take high income people who have been stuck in the American lifestyle, show them something that's different, and yet they can potentially conceive of it being good if it's described properly. And then people are trying this now, you know, by the thousands or maybe even by the millions. And I get all these emails all the time now, and they say it's like a light switched in their head, and they completely dropped all the old activities, picked up these new ones, went from saving 5% of their income to saving 75%. Suddenly they're able to retire 5 years from now instead of 40 years from now, and they're completely happier and 40 pounds lighter at the same time. So, and it's nothing magic. I'm not selling like an amazing, complicated formula that you need a DVD set to learn about. I'm actually just doing slightly less ridiculous stuff than the rest of the average, my fellow rich people.
Right.
Being a little bit, I'm still ridiculous, just not quite as ridiculous.
Well, no, listen, I had a plan, and one of the big plans was, as soon as my kids go away, we lived in a very large house in the neighborhood, right? So I said, you know what, when I get to the point where, and I set everything up, I set my office up, I set my house up, I set everything up that once they were all either in college or through college, I was going to actually move back to what I originally moved to Florida for, which is to be on the water, and I ended up living in a beautiful home, but essentially in the desert. There's no water anywhere where I was, and I bought a house on the water, which I'm in the process of fixing up right now, and my office closer so that I can, you know, and the house is essentially half the size. It's 2,200 square feet versus 4,300 square feet, you know, so it's kind of like this progression, and I totally get that. Again, you know, there's certain things I'll do and I won't do. I'm just telling you right now, I'm not going to be swimming. I'll be taking the boat. You know what I'm saying? It's just not happening. I'll be on the boat. You know, and it won't be a paddle boat, by the way. It will be with two engines, and it'll be, you know, pretty stinky and blowing smoke. You know, the thing is that I get what you're saying here. Now, people can find out more about this at the blog, MrMoneyMustache.com. And you do a lot of blogging about, you know, this whole financial freedom, I guess we'll call it, and, you know, kind of getting the fat off of and taking the excess out of life and how to do things with a lot of tips and stories and ideas and all that. So that's pretty cool stuff. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
I'm not growing a handlebar mustache, nor am I going to be having a bow tie anytime soon. But I can appreciate the whole idea of, you know what, doing what you want to do, making it right for you. And by the way, it doesn't matter if this is right for me or not. You know what? Maybe it's not right for somebody else out there, but you know what? It's cool for you. And if nothing else, maybe somebody can get a couple tips on, for example, you know, if you feel strapped, you feel burdened, you feel like you're, you know what? There's a lot of people out there. I mean, you know this, and I'm going to repeat back something obvious to you, but there's a lot of people out there that feel that they're stuck in life, right? They're stuck. There's no end job, dead end job. They're stuck at, you know, paying all these expenses, doing all these things they don't want to do, and they just keep doing it anyway. And what's really interesting about this is you only have one life. That's it. And then you're ant food. Done. Over. Now, whether or not you're going to heaven and believe all this, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about this life. You have one life to live, and why don't you just live it the way you want to? I think you'd agree with that.
Yeah, definitely. And getting yourself free from the need to work for money is kind of my idea. The first thing I wanted to accomplish in life. Now I got another 60 years left to figure out what's next.
Yeah, very nice. Well, maybe one day I'll meet you and we'll ride a bicycle through the woods or something together.
Yeah, it looks like I got some work to do on you still, but you're new to the Money Mustache world, so I expect some updates.
Well, maybe I'll just grow a scrubby one. You know, maybe just like a kind of a scrubby mustache. I took mine off a few years ago. Anyway, listen, thanks for joining us. Everybody should visit MrMoneyMustache.com, the blog. Lots to see you there. We'll have all the information on how to get there and other things that are offered that you could find out about this whole topic of, you know, financial freedom and kind of doing things a little bit differently than you may think of and that we usually talk about on this show. And we'll have it on this week's show notes on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Thanks again, buddy. Well, that was fun. That's talking about something a little bit different than we usually do. Obviously, we do focus on markets, but sometimes it's important to understand the bigger picture of finance and how others are doing it and how others are making it, how others are spending it or not spending it in this case. So Mr. Money Mustache, I put a picture of him actually on this episode. You go over to the show notes over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com for this episode of the podcast. And you'll see that the nice little mustache that he has there. Now, before we left and we started our interview with Pete, Mr. Money Mustache, I mentioned something about Apollo Management. Now, one of the things, this is Leon Black's Apollo Global Management. And I thought it was really interesting, this news item, that he's raising a new fund to essentially bet against corporate credit. And this is right in the face of this whole idea of, hey, wait a minute, boy, the balance sheets are so much better now for companies. And we're seeing that they got all these great loans, they're paying low interest rates, etc. And the same thing about how they are issuing debt. And they're in, no matter what the category, whether it's A rated, a B, C, they're getting some pretty good money in because it's an enormous chase for yield. Now, Apollo oversees about $167 billion in assets. And now they are trying to cash in as the concern grows over deteriorating debt markets. Now, the debt markets are, we're talking more so of the lower rated bonds. And they're seeing an increase in company defaults and the small difference in yields between treasuries and junk bonds as reasons for creating what they call the Apollo Credit Short Opportunities Fund. Now, that's really interesting. Now, one of the people over at Apollo said that all the danger signs are there for a future crisis, and we're back to doing exactly the same things that we've done in the credit markets during the crisis, which is kind of interesting. So they're looking for target returns of more than 50% if a 2008 type of financial crisis occurs and gains of about 1% to 3% in a more benign economic environment. Now, I'd be hard-pressed to say with all the fixes and all the changes that went in, not only in regulation, but also the money that was basically pushed into the banks and how they have done a good job of getting rid of their bad debt and good job of foreclosing or I don't know if it's a good job, you could say, but foreclosing on houses and getting rid of all of that off of their books and cleaning things up, I would be hard-pressed to say that in the near term, there is the chance for some kind of a 2008 financial crisis. But you have to ask yourself, okay, well, markets have been running on very cheap money for a long time. And when the Fed actually does one day, someday, who knows when, really increase interest rates, what happens to all those players that have been leveraging as much as they can, betting on the fact that the Fed is going to keep their interest rates at these low, ridiculously low levels for an extended period of time? What happens? How do they actually make money? How are they going to do what they do, spread the money out, and create this liquidity that we've seen in markets for some time? And if the case comes that there's going to be a slowdown, the amount of money that has been put out there on the street in terms of bonds and then the selling that goes on, does that cause a real problem to corporations that were relying on debt issuance to continue on with what they're doing? Now, you really have to look at the smaller companies, those that don't have the good credit ratings for whatever reason it may be, and those are the ones that will probably see the biggest problems. Now, even if there is no financial crisis at all, nothing, a normal correction, okay. But even if that is a understanding of what we're talking about here, if rates start to increase over time and the spreads between treasuries and junk expand to where they normally have been over time, you're still going to see a major drawdown in quote-unquote junk bonds or the non-credit quality, non-high credit quality, so let's say under triple B. I guess we'll call it under triple B. Under triple B, under double B, if you see that there's going to be an increase in interest rates, the spreads will widen dramatically. There's really no reason why they shouldn't. And the only reason why they're there right now is because it is impossible to get a decent interest rate anywhere. And as such, this push for yield and this chase for yield has been really prevalent in markets. And that being the case, what you see is that there is a incredible drop to the yields on junk, or the rise in their bond prices. And that probably is going to see a reversal in the next year or so, dependent on a few things, obviously, dependent on how aggressive the Fed is, depending on how the economy does here, depending on what geopolitical issues are out there. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into this. But if we go back to a quote-unquote normal economy, normal growth, nothing tremendous, but just normal, an unemployment rate that is, let's call it, in the mid-fives. If that all is the case and the Fed does start to ratchet up interest rates, the spreads are going to go dramatically wider. I got a few emails on this last week, as a matter of fact. And one of the things that was really interesting was that even though we did see that bonds had been falling for a couple of weeks prior to this week, you know, the only difference was that treasuries fell about 2%, where junk bonds fell about, and that's from like some of these ETFs like J&K and a few others, they only fell like 3%. That's not a big difference. There still is this big rush to get yield because there really is no other way. And if you're a pension fund or you're a corporate investor that's looking for a reasonable level of yield to keep pace with the overall normalized market conditions, which may have been 4%, you know, the old days, you can get 4% on a CD, right? Well, if you need that kind of rate to keep pace with your allocation and maybe your defined benefit plan and your pension plan that you have payouts due, et cetera, well, what are you going to do? Right? Where are you going to go? There's not many choices out there. So you're going to start, you know, kind of creeping down the ladder and going after some of those bonds that really don't have the ratings. So just think about that. Put JNK as an example, or HYG, on your screen somewhere. Keep an alert on that. Keep it on your monitor. Keep it somewhere in the background and watch the trend. Watch when it starts to convincingly break. Put TLT on there as well. You can kind of compare. And this is something that you may want to look into as well, looking to short these kinds of situations, because it may in fact be a very good moneymaker over time. So there you go. Well, we're not going to have a DH Unplugged this week. I know that. John Dvorak is on vacation or doing something, whatever he may be. But make sure to listen to me on the Curzio Show, which appeared this week. And if you have any questions about how we manage money, just write into us or go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out the Arrow Strategy, which is something you want to check out. It's our algorithm that we built over time that invests primarily in the S&P 500, in, out, short, long, dependent on the conditions of overbought versus oversold, that we have targeted using this algorithm. That's pretty well over time. And also the TDI managed growth strategy. And there's more information about all of that on the website. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.